You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. The amazing Martha Bolton is my guest this week. She is the author of 88 books. She was a writer for Phyllis Diller, one of my favorites, and she was a writer for Bob Hope. Her new book was created in collaboration with Bob Hope's daughter, Linda Hope, and it's called Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with GIs of World War II. Martha Bolton, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk about Bob Hope.
Well, I loved Bob Hope, and I especially loved his movies in the 30s and 40s, and of course the road pictures. And some of those things are just so great. Monsieur Beaucoup and all those great pictures. And of course, I was not alive during World War II. And because you look slightly less than 100 years old, I'm going to say you were probably not there either. When did you meet Bob Hope?
Well, I started writing for him in the 1980s, early 1980s, around 82, 83, and was with him till the end.
How did you get that gig?
90s, yeah.
Yeah, how did you get that job writing for Bob Hope?
Well, it you know, as life often does, it came from a disappointment. What happened was I had been writing for Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers and different comedians and sending my material out. And to my surprise, they were buying, and they'd always write little encouraging notes on there, so it kept me going. And I wanted to get in. I got a lot of encouragement that I should be, you know, writing for television or doing something sitcom wise. And so I had read this book by a gentleman named Gene Parrott, and he was a writer for the Carol Burnett Show, and then also the creative consultant for Mama's Family. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot in common, because when I read his book, he also wrote for Phyllis Diller, and then he also wrote roasts for his work. And I wrote roasts for different people's bosses, and for I would roast our pastor, and you know, just anybody that wanted to honor / have fun with their boss. So I just wrote him a letter and told him that we had this in common. I didn't ask for anything, just was writing him a complimentary book. it was a complimentary letter, not a book. But he contacted me and then invited me down to see a taping of Mama's Family. So I went down and I took this scrapbook that I had. At the time, I was writing a newspaper column as well, a humor newspaper column. So it had that in there. It had magazine articles that I had written, jokes I had written. So I had this poor man go through this scrapbook of all my material, and he was very complimentary, and he told me that I should be pursuing that as a career. So he suggested I write a spec script for Mama's Family. At the time, my typewriter wasn't working. So for a quarter, for 20 minutes, I went down to the local library and just kept feeding it quarters until I typed up two spec scripts and got it to him. And then he liked it and then got it to Ed Simmons, who was the producer. And Ed called me up and told me he really liked my work, and that the next season he was going to call me in to pitch some show ideas and possibly give me an assignment to write. So I was so excited. I couldn't believe it. It was this big break that I was getting. But as what happens in Hollywood, the show got canceled. Now, it ended up coming back, but at that period of time, it got canceled. So I was so disappointed. But from that, Gene also happened to be a writer for Bob Hope, and then he recommended me to Bob, and gave me an assignment. I had to write some jokes and turned them in and waited to hear back. And then one night, lo and behold, the phone rang and it was Bob Hope. And he told me that he loved my work and gave me some more assignments. And that just kept going. He'd call me and with assignments. And then I ended up coming on staff. And as it turns out, historically, I'm his first woman staff writer, a full-time staff writer. So.
And so when you joined the staff, did you then go and meet in a room with these guys?
Yeah, we started, then we'd have, well, we were working too. A lot of the assignments came by phone, but then during showtime, we would meet at his house and meet with him. And then
at Bob Hope's house in Toluca Lake.
Yeah. And so we'd all gather around this table that he had and just pitch ideas to him, which is pretty incredible when you think about it.
It's amazing.
Oh, man. And when we would do the tapings, because he ran in such an amazing crowd. So when we would do the tapings and say there was a line change that needed to happen. So, we'd meet together and we'd come up with lines, and then one or more of us would go into his dressing room to pitch the whatever lines that we had come up with. And you'd go in there and, Bob would be in his makeup chair getting his makeup put on. And there on the sofa could be Lucille Ball, George Burns, Milton Berle, and they're waiting to hear what you came up with, line wise. So it was pretty incredible, a lot of pressure, but they were all so nice. And you just kept pinching yourself. You couldn't believe that you were sitting there with all of these major comedy stars.
That's such an exciting story. Now, how old were you, if you don't mind my asking, when you joined Bob Hope staff?
Yeah, probably when I started, later 20s, 28, 29, somewhere around in there. And, first year of keeping up with his schedule, I was 48. No, but it ran, late 20s, but into my 30s and early 40s.
And did they treat you as an equal? Were they differential to you? How did it work?
Well, that's the interesting thing. They treated me so well, and I tend to be shy, so I would always kind of hold myself back. And had it not been for them being this way, I don't know how far I would have gotten, because they opened all the doors for me. They would, and I mean that figuratively, it just, come on, Martha, we're going to go into his dressing room. Come on, Martha, we're going to go talk to this star. They just kept pushing me beyond my limits and growing me. And they were so welcoming. They treated my material with every bit of respect as they treated their own. I never felt lesser than. We were all equals. And it was just there was three of us that started at the same time I did. Would be Doug Gamble and Philip Jason Lasker. Mm-hmm. And a pretty incredible team that we all started together. Now, Doug Gamble ended up writing for President Reagan, and then Philip Jason Lasker ended up writing and producing for the Golden Girls. So, and the whole team, everybody just, they just have such a legacy of accomplishment that is pretty incredible. So Bob knew how to pick people that had more in them than just writing for him.
Well, Martha Bolton, you're really good at gags. Did you realize that when you were a kid? I mean, were you the funny kid? And when did you realize you could write gags?
Well, 9 years old, I wrote this little book, those are composition books, and I still have them. But I wrote this little book called No Fun Being Young. And it was just a collection of funny stories about being the youngest of five. And then I started writing funny poems and some serious ones as well. So I have both sides of me. But I would tape them on the wall next to my bed. And I had about 35 of them, three rows of poetry that I taped and forced anybody that came over to spend the night to read them. But, you know, I could go back to that. And they ended up printing it. So that was another encouragement along that comedy line. And then I started writing plays. I wrote church pageants and comedy sketches and comedy plays and just kept going along that line and roasting the pastor. And then I got a lot of encouragement to start doing more. And so I started sending out jokes to different comedians that I thought I could match their style with Joan and Phyllis, the housekeeping. And even though I was still in my 20s and 30s, I was writing aging jokes, but they started buying. And so it was a real encouragement. And then of course, when that happened with Bob Hope, he was the ultimate, you know.
Can you remember a gag you wrote for Phyllis Diller?
I can the easy way. I just wait for my liver spots to connect. She was fun. She always wrote really nice notes on the sides of the pages, you know. She was a huge, and then she'd come on the Bob Hope Show. I had them both there. It was fun. Yeah.
And what about Joan Rivers? Can you remember anything you wrote for her?
Yeah, one was, I think that talking about her domestic and not being able to cook, for years my family thought mold was a frosting.
We're chatting with Martha Bolton. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Martha Bolton is the author of 88 books, and her newest one is called Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with the GIs of World War II.
Martha Bolton, when you came to work for Bob Hope on his staff, were there men there that had been working with him for decades, or were they always a turnover of writers?
See, that's the thing, is Bob was very loyal, and he had people that went back to him to World War II in radio. So Cy and Freddie, Seaman Jacobs and Freddie S. Fox, they went back to radio. Gene Parrott, I believe that by the end, he had been with him 30 years. Bob Mills had been with him over 15, I believe. I was with him 15. It's just, he just kept people. So he was pretty loyal. If you did your work and you turned it in and he liked your material, he kept you.
Bob Hope famously employed a lot of writers all through his whole career, he was a very funny physical comedian, but could he come up with gags as easily as you guys could?
Yeah, and ad-libs, although sometimes our assignment was to write his ad-libs, which is pretty funny. Uh-huh. But he could do it on the fly himself. All of those years in vaudeville, trained him to do that. If something happened in the audience, he had to be quick on his feet. And he always was throughout his career. One thing that I really admire about him too, that I think is a key to his success, I believe personally, I don't know if it's ever been proven, but I think he had almost a photographic memory, because he would call at all hours of the night, from whatever time zone he was in. So it was fine where he was at, but it'd be 2 o'clock in the morning where you were. But he would call, and if something was happening in the news where he was at and he's getting ready to go on stage, we'd have the assignment to write on whatever it was. And we would give him jokes, brand new jokes that he hadn't heard before. And he'd have like 10 or 20 or whatever, and he'd walk on stage and give these brand new jokes just from the phone call. I don't know how you do that
without a cue card or without anything.
With nothing, just from this phone call, and to get the wording right, because jokes are very, you can't slough through them. The words are every word has to count for the timing and everything, and so he would get them correct. And if you look at the videos of him on YouTube, of the old World War II videos, those shows there was no cue cards. they were, it was straight from memory. The writers would give him jokes pertaining to that area, and those officers that he would tease, he had their names, he had the new jokes, he had, it was all tailored to wherever he was at, and it's all straight from memory. Plus, you look at how fast he was talking. That wasn't somebody that was just stumbling over their words. He was delivering it, boom, boom, boom. Amazing. Amazing.
He had little tricks that he would use, I think, in the way that normal people would go, or he would say, and I want to tell you, or
to kind of. Even that doesn't buy you much time. So you got to know what you're doing. Yeah.
Martha Bolton, this book that you and Linda Hope put together is called Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with GIs of World War II. And so many of the GIs that wrote him do call him Bob. It's very interesting that people felt like they knew him. I don't think people would have written to, I don't know, maybe they would have, but I guess comedians people are more familiar with, but people really did feel like Bob was their pal.
Yeah, yeah. They would write Dear Bob. They would write Dear Buddy. They would write Dear Pal, Dear Dad. They felt that connection. He was family to them. They would also, in their letters, say, because I feel like I know you, I know you won't take offense to me calling you Bob, or I know you won't. So they had figured him out, who he was, and they just had a confidence that he was their buddy.
And that reminds me of a question I wanted to ask you. You talked about roasts and even roasting your pastor, and I can't imagine that pastors take all that kindly to being roasted. But and you've also talked about the minutia of putting together a gag, you know, one word at a time. Do you have to be careful how mean your roasts can be?
Well, they shouldn't be mean at all. They should come from the reason why you're roasting somebody is because you respect them and you love them, and you're taking quirks about them that they would joke about themselves. You're taking memories of things that had happened that were funny, and then you get up and you talk about it and remind people about it, you know. But they're laughing too. And if your person of honor is not laughing at what you're delivering, then you're doing it wrong. They should leave feeling absolutely loved and absolutely respected, and they just had a great time themselves, much less the audience. You do not put them up there to have a firing squad at them. That's not what it's about. And it should be fun. And most of the roasts in the past, the old roasts, that's how it was. They would say funny things, and then the camera would always go to the person of honor, and you'd see them laughing. And if you didn't see them laughing, then you know, that would be going to a bad place. So that was the goal, was to make them laugh even more than the audience. Gotta know your boundaries, and that's important. That's probably the most important thing that a young comedian can learn, is boundaries. Because if they're hired for a business, you know, the business is responsible for what comes out of their mouth. And, you know, everybody takes that serious. So you really have to be careful. And unfortunately, some comedians learn that the hard way.
Comedy is serious business, is what you're saying.
Yes, very, very serious. You have to take it pretty serious, but have fun, but make sure that everybody's having fun.
Now, this book, Dear Bob, it's really like a time machine going back to World War II on almost like a daily basis. And there's more letters to Bob than there are from. But did Bob's responses, did he write his own letters back? Do you think his writers employed some help?
Well, I think he wrote that. I think he wrote, you know, dictated a lot of them to the secretary, Marjorie Hughes at the time. But he did it. I mean, it's his voice. And when you know his voice, you can pretty well tell that this is Bob popping in and, you know, working on his GI. He called it his GI mail. And he took it. I believe that it was not something that he gave off to other people to handle. He had met these kids. He had seen them not only in his audience, but sometimes in bed at a hospital. He had walked with them, and there's such personal connections that only he would know. So it's his voice coming through, talking about this kid that he met somewhere, or this you know, officer or whatever the situation was. And then they'd talk about it back and forth. Well, a writer couldn't do that. He wouldn't know that. The secretary couldn't even do that. They wouldn't know these people to know how to answer as specifically as he answered in many of the letters. This was something that was close to his heart. In fact, Linda and I started this when Bob was alive. And I had talked with Bob, because I had seen the letters and seen what was in them. And I asked him if he had ever thought about putting them into a book, because I thought they'd make a really great book. And he said at that time that he agreed that it would be a great book, but he was so close to these letters, he didn't know if he could read them again. And that I should talk with Linda. And so Linda and I started having meetings about it, and started working on it back then, and got pretty far along. And then things happen, and you get out, you know, this project or that project. But I never forgot about the book, and she never did either. And she had grown up with the letters and even did a high school paper on them. And so we, you know, it stayed in both of our minds and in our hearts. And then a few years ago, she contacted me and said, "Do you want to get back on that book?" And I was so excited, because I didn't know exactly where it stood, and could not wait to get back on it. So by that time, the letters were up at the Library of Congress. They had been moved from his house, which is where they were when we were working on it before. And then now they were up at the Library of Congress. So I started going up there, finished the research, and would work on the manuscript, send it off to her, and she'd make great suggestions. And then I'd incorporate those and just kept going on it. And then it was going to come out. Last year, the University Press of Mississippi came on board, and we were hoping it would come out last year with the anniversaries and whatnot. And then with COVID, a lot of those got canceled, but it came out this March. And after we all survived 2020, you know, and everything that everybody had gone through, the loss and everything that happened, I think we're all looking for hope right now. And
Bob Hope.
Yes. And we all, you know, just, we're ready for this. And Bob was always known for his timing, and I think he's still doing it.
Yeah. I mean, there's some many funny lines and some laugh out loud things, but it's a poignant book. And there's a lot, I mean, it's a, on the whole, a serious work.
Yeah.
Would you say so? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Now Bob Hope continued to entertain troops long after World War II. In fact, he got a lot of flack, I think, for going to Vietnam and, you know, because of the anti-war movement and so on. And he became a kind of a symbol of hawkism or whatever. Did he continue to get letters from soldiers throughout his lifetime?
He did. And Bob makes it clear, when you read this book, you clearly see that Bob was no fan of war. He had seen what war does. He had seen these kids, the sacrifice that they paid. And because of their sacrifice and their willingness to do what they had to do, he had promised to be there for the troops, no matter what. And he was. And he was faithful to that promise that he made to Roosevelt back in World War II, was only for World War II. But he kept it up for every war and engagement that went on. But it was for the troops. And that comes clear in these letters. The troops know and knew that of all people, Bob Hope was there for them and he had their backs, even in peace. He didn't forget about them when they came home. It was all about being there for the troops. And that transcended everything. He just had made a commitment to be there. And he had heard so many stories and had met so many young men, not only that came home to thank him, but the ones that didn't make it home. He had met them. They were in his shows. There was one show he did where 60% of the audience was killed in the next battle. Mm-hmm. You can't unexperience that. That is something that is in your heart, and it stayed with him his whole life. And he was with, he did these shows for 50 years. So Roosevelt had no idea when he suggested, why don't you, because Bob wanted to enlist, and he suggested, why don't you entertain the troops? You would be more valuable to the troops to entertain them. And he was only really referring to World War II. He had no idea he was getting a 50-year commitment from this man. Up until his last military show, he was 87 years old. Going, you know, climbing in and out of helicopters, going up as close to the front lines as he could get, just to be there and be there, fulfill that promise, but also to be there for the GIs and for them to see that he wasn't ever going to give up on them. It was the only thing that stopped him was his 90s, his age. But
what would you say to cynics, possibly, who say that Bob Hope was merely exploiting those soldiers? He always got good laughs when he played at those audiences. They were always, applauding loudly, and it made him look good, and so on.
Well, this is what I would say. At the height of World War II, Bob was receiving 38,000 fan mails a week. I would say you need to read some of these letters. And if you think that that was about Bob Hope, you're absolutely wrong, because it was all about the GIs.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're chatting this week with Martha Bolton. She's the author of 88 books. The most recent is called Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with the GIs of World War II.
There's nothing like 100,000 letters in here. How did you choose what letters you would use for your book?
Well, that was the hardest part of the entire, project, was deciding which ones would go in. And it's kind of funny because the book kept getting bigger because we'd find another one that, oh, this has to go in, this has to go in. And then it's too big. We got to bring it down. So it kept doing that. That was probably the main thing that we would have to work on is which letters would go in. And as you know, they're divided, not necessarily chronologically. It does take you through the war beginning to end, but in the middle, how the letters are divided up, the letters about their, missing their mother, those are together. The letters about, I won't be home for Christmas, those are together. Their complaints about food or whatever, those are together. The funny ones are interspersed with all of that as well. So it just takes you on this read through all these letters it takes you inside the GI's hearts, and it takes you inside Bob Hope's heart. And it's pretty amazing what's on those pages.
I agree. And it's also very, I've got a lot of photographs, and it's also really interesting to see the things that people sent to him, drawings, yeah, and matchbooks or whatever, all kinds of little items.
That part I found fascinating, things that they would find, they'd send it to Bob for a souvenir. Here, I found this, or funny things that they found. They'd find lookalike pictures and then they'd send it to Bob. This guy, this one painting, this knight was in this one painting, and they said, how obviously, you know, we weren't the only generation that enjoyed you. You know, it was back in 1500s. It's just incredible what they would send as if he was their brother. It would be something that you would send a family member. Look what I found. But they would send it to Bob and he'd joke right back, you know.
I guess that's a tribute to radio because Bob Hope was in their ear every week.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And even when they couldn't hear the show, like it's say the rule was the lights out at certain time, they would sneak. In fact, there's one officer that took a picture of them sneaking under their blankets, and there's a bunch of them together, and they're, you know, hiding as they listen to the show together, and, you know, sneaking a listen. It's just amazing the connection that he had, and so many of them from the hospitals as well, where they were afraid they wouldn't get to hear the show because they had the same rules and whatnot. And then especially if they had their face bandaged up and they couldn't see anything, or they were just feeling very, very depressed, and they thought they weren't going to be able to make it through another night. And then that familiar voice would come over the radio. And for some reason that night they let the GIs listen to his show, and they were just writing to thank him for everything he meant to them, and that they were so pleased that they got to listen to his show.
Well, Martha Bolton, when you met Bob Hope, he was already 80 or so, and yet you got to work with him for 15 years because he lived to be 100 years old.
I know.
It's incredible. And now as a writer, writing for a comedian known for his speed and so forth, did he, as he was growing older in those 15 years, did he slow down, or did you have to tailor your writing to his speech?
You know, it's interesting. He was, and you're right, I started, you know, when he was in his 80s. And at the time, you know, I had been writing for a few other people, and there a few other opportunities had came up at that exact time. And, you know, my husband was kind of leaning toward maybe I should think about a younger comedian or whatnot. And I was, no, but it's Bob Hope, you know. So I went with Bob because I was just thrilled to be writing for him. And who knew that he would keep on going to 100? But it was pretty amazing. And we would finish one show. Say the show was one overseas, and he would come home from having finished all of the taping for that show. And he'd fly home, this long flight home. And as soon as he got to the airport, he'd call you up and say, well, what are we going to do for the next show? I mean, his work ethic and his love of comedy and his love of his career and what the fun he would have at every show, it never waned. And he's in his 80s and 90s, and he's still excited about each of the shows. Now, when he did start slowing down, it had very little to do with his desire to slow down. He had some eyesight problems that started happening. And so we had to, the cue cards would have to be very, very large for him to see them. And it was a pretty serious eye situation that progressed. And that was really, really what slowed him down. And then, you know, then he retired. But I think if it wasn't for that, I think he probably would have kept on going. Who knows, you know? And, you know, you know, of course, there's other things that happen when you're pushing 100. But he lived an incredible life and kept it going till he had, you want to say nothing left? He used it all, but I don't know, you know, maybe he still had more to go. If people lived to 200, he might've been one of those that just kept on going, you know, who knows?
After he retired and you were no longer writing for him, did you ever see him again or talk to him?
Yeah, because we would, there were times when if he had an appearance or something, sometimes I'd get the assignment for that. But he also had, there was a lot of events where he was honored in Washington and different places. So you'd get invited to that and then you'd see him at those events. And pretty, you know, as you know, he's one of the most, he is the most honored and recognized as far as attribute wise and award wise entertainer in history. So according to the Guinness Book of World Records. So
the performer of the 20th century.
Yes. Yeah.
During the time that you were on his staff, did you ever socialize with him? Did he ever take you guys to lunch or was it always work?
No. We do that. And he had parties at his house and at different, like his office manager's house. And then he'd pop in and sit and, you know, visit with all of us and joke around. And sometimes there was a football game on and we'd, it just, yeah, he was very social. And what was interesting too, that I always found interesting, was at his parties, not only would he have greats there, you know, legends, presidents, these are the formal parties, like his 90th birthday party. He would invite his staff. He would invite the gardener and his family, and he'd invite everybody that was connected with him. He just was all inclusive. He wanted to give everybody a good time. And thousands, I believe, were on his Christmas card list. As far as throughout the book, you see GIs that thank you for the Christmas card you sent and I wasn't expecting it, or the first year you were here, I expected it that year, but then you sent it the next year and the next year. And he had a plane crash during World War II in Australia. And they had to do a water landing in this river. And Bob had been at the controls when the engine went out. It was no fault of his, but the pilot, you know, had to take over and do a, like a Captain Sully and do a water landing. And they all were rescued. And they went into the little town, like 600 people. And they convinced them, the troop, it was Bob and the whole troop. So the whole troop would have been wiped out. And they said, had they not landed on the water, had they hit the sandbar first, the plane would have somersaulted most likely and killed them all. So so they were all celebrating the fact that they had literally dropped out of the sky. Hollywood had dropped out of the sky on this little teeny town. So they convinced, the town convinced Bob and the troop to put on a show just for them. And so they did. And then after the show, they all did rounds of hokey pokey until 4 a.m. with the whole troop. And then the reason why I'm sharing it right now is because that town, everybody in that town received Christmas cards from him for years. So it was just amazing that way. And I'm sure Dolores had a lot to do with that as well, but they were just touchable. They were approachable. They never put themselves above the people.
Pretty amazing. Well, when I read that story about the airplane in your book, Dear Bob, Martha Bolton, I was wondering, did you know that story before you started researching this book? Did Hope ever tell you that tale?
I believe I heard about it. No, he hadn't. But I believe I heard about it when the first time, back when he was alive. And then I was blown away with it because I had never heard about it. It was such an intriguing story. And then the more I read about the story, because when they went into town after they got rescued, Bob tried to send a telegram through the postmaster, And he told them who he was. And the postmaster didn't believe him and told him that he was much too busy for his, you know, his jokes. So Bob finally convinced him that it was him. And then because he landed and wasn't prepared to land, he had to borrow 11 pounds from the postmaster to get a room and food. So it's pretty incredible. And he did pay it back. So just amazing stories.
A lot of great stories. Now, I want to ask you, when you were writing for Phyllis Diller, for instance, were you on her staff as well, or you just supplied her with gags?
That was just for gag. So I would send her gags and then she'd send back with checks next to the one she was buying and then a check. But I got to know her and she was so complimentary and so encouraging. And we would, Gene, the gentleman that used to write for her as well, we'd take her out to dinner and socialize with her. And she just, I'd go to her house once in a while. So she was real instrumental in my career.
What a pioneer she was. She must have been inspiring.
Yes, yes. And just so loving, and would send me little gifts and little cards and just saying encouraging things. And she was just a wonderful mentor. And she would do that as well. If a joke wasn't quite on, she'd write and tell me, you know, why don't you try this or why don't you try that? So she was great.
Yes, a wordsmith herself.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, she told me once, which is really a cool quote, I thought, that when she and Bob would get together, it was like two little kids playing in a sandbox of words.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, I wonder about her because she basically wore a costume whenever you saw her performing, with her hair and her mini skirts or whatever she wore. And it got more outrageous as time went on. But so when you went out to dinner with her, I mean, would people recognize her, or could she just be, you know, when she was as her regular self, she didn't look like Phyllis Diller?
You know, it was funny. We went to this restaurant and we were all, you know, sitting and talking and laughing. And this lady walks over from another table and she's just, oh, Phyllis, and talking and talking. And I, you know, just we were just waiting and listening. You know, obviously it was a friend of hers that just, you know, they hadn't seen each other in a while, but it just kept going on and on. And so the lady walked away, and then Phyllis goes, I have no idea who that person was. But she would pretty much go out, not outrageous. It would be just a nice outfit. You know, it depended on the occasion. But in her house, she had a room that was just for her costumes, and just row after row of these outrageous costumes. And I don't know how many were in there, but just row, just as like a store rack, but a bunch of store racks and just lined up. And then she also had a wig room that was for all of her outrageous wigs. So it's pretty incredible.
Well, you know, of course, one of the kind of things that they always tell comedians is you should never laugh at your own jokes. Although she had this wonderful laugh that went before and after every joke she ever told.
She did. And it was more, I think it was more, rather than laughing at her jokes, it was almost like, can you believe that? You know, I mean, it's like we're together. Isn't that, you know, it's like nudging somebody with your elbow when you hear, you know, it was kind of that way where, you know, she knew it was funny, but it wasn't like, I think it's funny and it's cracking me up. It was more like they're together and I'm just nudging you. Right? And that isn't that funny. Small difference there, but I think she could do it.
She could. Well, so it's amazing, Martha Bolton, that you've worked with such great geniuses and contributed to their careers behind the scenes. It's wonderful to meet you. The book is called Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with the GIs of World War II, written with Bob Hope's oldest daughter, Linda Hope, Martha Bolton. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.